or I could do now that might be counted appropriate, except perhaps to lay down and die of shame. And I was not about to give anyone that satisfaction.
I wasn't sure you'd come back to me,
Hamilton admitted that night, rocking his infant son against his shoulder and eyeing the two empty wine bottles on our table with a furrowed brow.
Unless...
Unless, I asked, covering a hiccup.
Unless you've returned to hire a divorce attorney.
His eyes crinkled at the corners, as if he'd said it in dark jest, but there was an edge of fear to it. He watched me carefully for an answer even as he continued.
As it happens, I'm acquainted with the best in the city, if you should need a recommendation.
Though I was a little tipsy and unsteady on my feet, I stood to embrace him. I'm with you, Alexander. And I was. For even though the world didn't wish for us to put our troubles behind us, we'd done it. We'd survived. And we'd become stronger for it. Alexander swallowed, then, with our little William between us, pressed his forehead to mine.
You are infinitely dear to me, Eliza.
And I am more in debt to you than I can ever pay. Please believe that I know you deserve everything from me, and my future life will be devoted to your happiness. I only wish I could stay.
He was obliged to argue a federal case in Connecticut, one of the many cases he took on to make a fine future for our children and build the house he promised. Still, he worried, because our oldest boy, Philip, had taken ill on the boat as we'd sailed back from Albany. A summer cold, we thought. Nothing serious. But days after my husband went off to Connecticut, as Philip tossed and turned feverish in his bed, the physician pronounced the dread verdict. Typhus. Typhus could leave our boy deaf or addled, or it could kill him.
Mrs. Hamilton, you must prepare for the worst,
the doctor said, his coat thrown over the chair by the bed where my son burned with fever.
Your husband must be sent for.
Send a courier by express, I whispered. Then I sent the rest of the children and my servants away, lest the illness spread. Angelica insisted on staying with me, so it was me, my sister, and the doctor left to care for Philip, as he slipped into a state of delirium, his pulse fading by the moment. I took Philip's face in my hands and told him a truth that mothers ought never utter, that he would always be my firstborn and first in my heart. Because Philip was too weak to move on his own, the three of us plunged him into a hot bath of Peruvian bark and rum. When he roused, I spooned wine whey into his mouth while his Aunt Angelica covered him in dry blankets. But the nightmare continued as we waited for my husband's return, listening with anxiety for every chime of the clock. At length, my sister said, Eliza, let me sit with him while he sleeps. You should rest so his mother can be with him when he awakens. I started to my room, stumbling away in a delirium of my own. Don't take him, God, I prayed that night, and again the next morning. Not Philip, who'd brought joy to us since the day he was born. Not the boy who'd been my companion during those lonely early years when his father was seldom home. Not my Philip. The best of me and Alexander combined. Our best and brightest hope. I'd just finished uttering this morning prayer when boots thundered up the stairs, the door shaking at the noise of it.
Eliza!
I found Alexander in the hall, his hair plastered to his head in sweaty ringlets, his legs spattered in mud, eyes wild. Is he... Awake, Angelica said from the doorway. And it's no wonder with all the racket. We rushed into our son's room to find him revived, sensible as to where he was and who we were, and we knelt beside his bed and thanked God for his deliverance. Later, while Alexander cooled his forehead with a cloth, I thought nothing else matters but this.
Let the newspapers say what they would. Let every woman in the country giggle behind their hands and whisper behind my back. Our family mattered more. Our family meant everything. And so long as we were together, I could bear anything. Hamilton is fallen for the present. But even if he fornicates with every female in New York and Philadelphia, he will rise again. David Cobb to Henry Knox. Winter, 1797, New York City.
We'll never see her again, will we? My daughter rasped. As we watched the snow-covered carriage roll away from the front of our house, a tearful Fanny pressing her hand to the frosted window in farewell. Of course we will, I said, fighting back my own tears for my daughter's sake. Fanny may not have been her sister by blood, but Anna had never known another, and the loss seemed to break her. She alternated between inconsolable sobs and dazed stupors, and it was all I could do to comfort her about something that broke a piece of me, too. Because Fanny's relations no longer saw fit to let her stay with us. Her married older sister wanted to take Fanny into her household, a respectable household, I was brusquely informed. Thus, we were forced to surrender the girl we'd loved as our own since the age of two. We'd packed 12-year-old Fanny's trunks with new petticoats and pearled combs and every sort of frippery a girl should need. Alexander had vowed to the girl that she was always welcome back. We were all heartbroken at the loss. And to comfort my 12-year-old daughter, I said, "It's no different than when your Aunt Angelica went to live in London for a while. Fanny will come back one day, and you'll have each other's company again." But Anna could not be comforted. She'd always been a sensitive child, but lively and clever, eager to show off her accomplishments in dancing, music, and French. Now she withdrew to her room, complaining of illness. And I wondered if the danger to my children was never to end. The physicians could find nothing whatsoever wrong with her, but she would eat next to nothing but little bits of bread. Sometimes, even then, she left the crumbs upon her windowsill for the birds. Like her father, she took loss hard, and my heart ached for her. I knew what it was to love a sister, how tight that bond could be, how difficult it was to understand one's place in the world without it. In Anna's tenderness, the way only feeding these little birds could lift her spirits, I thought I recognized in her my own calling. Thus, one Sunday morning, I said, "Get dressed for church services, darling. Afterward, we're going to help some children as needy as our dear Fanny once was." Thereupon, we threw ourselves into a cause to which I was happy to lend my name, tainted though it was. The Society for the Relief of Poor Widows with Small Children, founded by the devout Scotswoman Widow Graham, supported at least 100 destitute widows in the city. Together with Anna, I spent afternoons assembling baskets of food and clothing for the needy in hopes of saving them from the poorhouse. I'd always felt best when I was busy. Besides, the unfortunate situations of these widowed women reminded me that my troubles were comparatively few. How fortunate I was. How the Lord had made me rich in every way that mattered. I imagined that it made the same impression on Anna because, by summer, she was playing her piano again for our old friend James McHenry, the Secretary of War. He came to visit in a show of loyalty and support, reciting poetry and recalling old war stories well into the evening. "To Lafayette," McHenry said, raising his glass. "The luckiest frog alive." "To Lafayette," we said. Because the Marquis was lucky, alive, and, after 5 years of imprisonment, free. Napoleon Bonaparte saw to Lafayette's release from prison, the only thing of merit, by my estimation, that tyrant ever did. And when we learned of Lafayette's release, Alexander wrote, "My friendship for you will survive all revolutions and all vicissitudes.
The only thing in which our parties agree is to love you.
After we drank, McHenry sat back and put his knife on the edge of his plate.
This veal is delicious, Mrs. Hamilton. Melts in the mouth like butter, it does. You serve as fine a meal as I remember from the old days.
You must be forgetting that dreadful wartime tripe stew. Mac patted a somewhat rounder belly than he'd had in those far-off days in winter quarters.
I was so hungry during the war, you could have baked me a sawdust cake and I'd have savored it. But this meal is exquisite. Have you a chef?
Oh, no, I replied. We've an Irish girl who scrubs the pots, but I do the cooking. McHenry seemed impressed.
Hamilton, my lucky friend, your wife is still as frugal and good a treasurer of your household as you were a treasurer for the country.
Better,
Hamilton said, smiling at me with warm affection.
After all, no one has ever demanded an investigation into her account books.
We laughed. Then Mac shook his head.
I worried, you know, all those years ago in Morristown. How the devil did a man like Hamilton see fit to marry such a saintly girl? Now I see, Mrs. Hamilton, that you were the only woman tireless enough to match him.
Dear Mac, it was the sixth or seventh compliment he'd paid me that evening, and I was sure he did it out of a solicitousness of my feelings, to try to soothe the blows dealt by the newspapers. But he was also trying to soften the ground, because between the second and third courses, Mac revealed the true purpose of his visit, to recruit my husband back into the army.
The French have gone too far this time, and it's likely to be war.
Offended by America's proclamation of neutrality in the European War, the new French government had been attacking our ships, and refused to speak to an American diplomatic delegation without a bribe. To make matters worse, a French ship plucked an American vessel right out of New York Harbor.
The gall of it. Nay, the gall of it.
Mac guffawed, finishing his fourth glass of Madeira.
Not even Jefferson dares to defend the French for this. And we need you back in uniform, lad.
How relieved I was when Alexander put his hand atop mine and said, without hesitation,
I'm a private man now, and considering the circumstances of—
Oh, damn the scandal sheets,
Mac cried. I'd been certain that my husband was going to talk about the circumstances of our finances and growing family, but realizing that even our friends and champions were still thinking about our scandal made me rise abruptly. Dessert! By the time I returned with chocolate creams in fluted crystal glasses and a silver tray of caraway confits, McHenry was still talking about the military.
As you say, General Schuyler has not been well. Gates is a bitter old woman. Knox is too stout to ride a horse. And if you didn't know it already, let me be the first to tell you that the great man won't come out of retirement unless you do, Ham.
Washington. Always George Washington was needed at the head of our armies. But even with my husband at his side, could the old venerable soldier truly mount up for war yet again? Mac eyed me frankly and turned to the screws.
I appeal to the inextinguishable love you bear your country, that you both bear your country.
I dropped into a chair with a sigh, stabbing a long spoon into my chocolate cream and digging out a giant bite, because I knew where this would end. Hamilton could never refuse military glory or a genuine call to patriotism, and this was both. Darkly amused but wanting to break things, I said, "To think I once harbored such a fondness for you, McHenry." Both men slanted apologetic glances my way. Then Alexander squinted.
What rank would I be offered? Major General.
McHenry reached for a few caraway confits, but I snatched the tray away. Yes, I was quite fond of you, Mac. Now I shall go get that sawdust cake for you after all. Mac laughed, merriment in his eyes.
But you were born to be a general's wife, my dear. Then to my husband, he added, "And you might wish to send a note of appreciation to President Adams. 'Twould be a good deal easier to make you inspector of the whole army if he didn't hate you quite so much."
Adams was an honest but irascible man who paled in stature beside George Washington, which was why my husband had supported another candidate in the presidential election instead of John Adams. But Adams had a long memory, and in backing the wrong horse, Alexander had made another enemy. An enemy who'd now be his commander-in-chief. March 1799, New York City.
"You're a shameless woman, Eliza Hamilton."
Standing beneath an umbrella in a drizzle of rain, Kitty Livingston tried to fend me off. After she'd come to warn me about Alexander that time, we'd come to a sort of rapprochement, and since then, Kitty had been amongst the first New York ladies to receive me back into polite society, despite her family's political feud with mine. But now, caught in a spring shower that was getting her shoes wet outside the Tontine, she wanted nothing more than to escape. I stood stubbornly in her path.
"Surely you can spare more for a worthy cause, Kitty. Not so long ago you were a widow with a small child yourself. I've already given you every coin in my handbag."
I smiled sweetly, and I promised to record that in the charity's membership roll, which we'll publish as thanks and recognition.
"As extortion," Kitty protested, "I'll be made to look like a miser compared to your sister."
Kitty had the right of it. I'd learned from Hamilton after all. Long ago, he'd arranged the order of the states in voting for the ratification of the Constitution, playing one against the other. Well, the same principle applied to raising funds for the Society for the Relief of Poor Widows with Small Children. And Angelica was my Delaware, always first to ratify. Knowing just how large my sister's donation had been, Kitty's hands tightened on her purse strings.
"You're a brigand."
"I think of myself as a foot soldier for the Lord." She pursed her lips.
"Well, I suppose that if General Hamilton gets the war against France he wants, we'll all have to adopt the martial spirit."
General Hamilton. After 4 months, I was still adjusting to the idea, much less the unspoken but very real responsibilities of being a general's wife. My mother, Lucy Knox, Martha Washington. These were my examples. And with those excellent ladies in mind, I said, "We're already at war with France. An undeclared war, but a war nonetheless." Lacking any military experience of his own to draw upon, President Adams had called George Washington out of retirement. The old soldier, tired to his very bones, agreed to serve as a figurehead if Alexander was named his second-in-command, his Inspector General. And no one could deny Washington. The Republican newspapers screeched against Hamilton, the man who published a book to prove he was an adulterer. But such objections seemed stale, if not quaint, when weighed against the threat of Napoleon Bonaparte. Matrons might clutch their pearls, and the Jeffersonians might spit, but in the end the country still needed Alexander Hamilton. Which meant that we were, again, ascendant. Even the Livingstons knew it. Which was why Kitty sighed with surrender, promising a large banknote for the charity. With that, she took her leave, but not before muttering, "I still say you're a brigand."
"Brigands resort to pistols."
Aaron Burr doffed his cap as he splashed across the street to us.
"Whereas you, Mrs. Hamilton, have somehow managed to loot the pockets of every New York notable with only the force of your will."
New York was a much smaller place in those days, and we were always running into old friends and enemies on the street. Burr, in particular, was always out and about. He had never remarried after Theodosia's death, and more often than not he had a trollop on his arm, two, if the mood struck him. He'd earned a reputation as a great seducer of women, and it was no wonder, since Burr still retained roguish good looks.
so much so that even I could scarcely deny him a smile. Nor did I want to when he took money from his pocket and pressed it into my hand.
For your widows and small children.
How generous, I said, surprised.
On the condition that you don't record my name in your ledger.
It's a respectable charity, sir, and entirely without partisan bent.
Yes, I've heard all about your widows.
By way of explanation, he added,
I spend a great deal of time lately on Slaughterhouse Street, raising mugs in the Bull's Head Tavern with the immigrants your husband's party is trying to chase out of the country.
He was referring to the Alien and Sedition Acts, which authorized President Adams to deport any foreign-born resident deemed a danger to the peace. These were wartime measures. And given what I'd seen, riots, uprisings, and American cities nearly burned to the ground, regrettably necessary, I thought, even though I worried it set a dangerous precedent. But I said none of this to Aaron Burr. I merely adjusted my bonnet, upon which I proudly wore a black cockade that signaled my support of this Federalist administration. Burr must have seen that I was suppressing an argument, because he gave a wicked grin.
I intend to make Hamilton regret these unconstitutional laws.
It was Congress who passed these laws, and the President who signed them. My husband was merely the general who would defend the nation. But, affecting amusement, I said, Unconstitutional? I don't remember your having championed that document when my husband was helping to write it.
Burr laughed. Touché. It's a miserable paper machine. I told your husband that, as the commander of an army, he owes it to the country to demolish it.
I withheld my gasp, because his expression was so droll I couldn't decide if he was toying with me or suggesting the overthrow of the government. Exasperated, I shook my head. I won't allow you to bait me further, sir, and I shall happily take your donation. But why should you desire to keep it a secret?
Because I mean it for charity and not social advancement.
Did Burr suspect me of using good works to erase the taint of scandal? It was perfectly in keeping with the way his mind worked, so I supposed I couldn't be angry about it. The truth was, despite Burr's capacity to scandalize, needle, or otherwise irritate me, I couldn't hate him. In truth, I even liked him. A little.
As much as anyone could like a man whose sole fixed characteristic was that he had none.
Perhaps it was because he'd kept his silence about my husband's adultery. Even if you insult me, I'm not too proud to take your money on behalf of children who are grateful for every scrap of bread.
I mean no insult whatsoever, though if I did, I suppose I should fear being clasped in irons or sued into penury under the new Federalist reign of terror.
At that, my jaw dropped. It's your Republicans who aspire to guillotines. You might be glad of the new laws if you'd been persecuted so relentlessly by the newspaper, as I
say no more,
Burr replied wryly, holding up a hand in surrender.
I've taken endless amusement watching the way you've spent the past year and a half hectoring the buttoned-up society ladies who had the temerity to shun you. I admire it. Hamilton has in you a very well-matched wife, as I intend to tell him at this evening's meeting of the Manumission Society.
I softened to hear this reminder of his anti-slavery work, especially as our political parties seemed often now on the verge of civil war. Just last year, two congressmen had come to blows with cane and fire-iron tongs on the floor of the House of Representatives. It was heartening to remember that there were men like Burr in the opposing camp who could still find common cause on great moral issues. And it made me forgive his taunts, because it seemed he did in fact have some moral scruples. My husband seems quite hopeful that New York will soon eliminate the practice of slavery. Do you share his optimism?
Burr's smile was enigmatic.
I suspect it would go better to first eliminate slavery a little closer to home. At least, it would spare your husband some embarrassment.
We keep no slaves, I said, with perhaps more pride than I ought to have, given that more than half the members of the society did own slaves, including my father.
As will be discussed at tonight's meeting, your husband is the purchaser of record for a slave the Manumission Society is seeking to help gain her freedom.
I shook my head dismissively. I'm sure there's been some mistake. We have no slaves.
But your sister does,
Burr replied. Ensconced amongst her perfumes and cosmetic pots in her toilette, Angelica admired her reflection in an ivory-handled mirror. Did Kitty wave the white flag? She promised a banknote, I replied, cooing a bit over my sister's 10-month-old baby in his ornate walnut bassinet, the child being ample proof that whatever had broken between my sister and her husband had indeed been mended. Angelica waved away a little yawn. I'd forgotten how exhausting a baby can be, even if you give them over to a nursemaid. As gently as one could possibly suggest such a thing, I ventured, perhaps if you hosted fewer parties. But Church lives for parties. He's rich and has no place in politics, so he has little to do and time hangs heavy on his hands. I couldn't imagine having little to do. Indolence wasn't in our Dutch blood. And I sensed Angelica was annoyed by it, too, but I hadn't come to criticize either of them. I'd come to ask, nay, to demand, "You must let Sarah go free." My sister startled. "Sarah? Your lady's maid," I replied stiffly. "I am informed today that Alexander purchased her for you." "Oh, yes," Angelica said, as if only vaguely recalling it. "When I knew we were returning to America, I asked Hamilton to ensure I'd have a servant when I disembarked the ship, and he did me that favor." My husband never purchased slaves for our household, yet his entanglement with my slave-owning family had put him in difficult positions and pushed him to compromise his moral stance more than once. It did not sit well with me that he might have done this for me in order to make my sister more apt to stay in New York, which he knew would make me happy. "You must emancipate her. She's gone to the Manumission Society for help. They mean to argue her cause publicly." A sense of indignation leaped to my sister's wounded expression at the idea she should be thought a bad mistress. "Why should Sarah wish to leave me? I've never treated her harshly for even a moment, and to beg the Manumission Society's help? This is mortifying." "Yes," I said, because slavery was mortifying. We'd grown up with Prince guarding our door, and Dinah cooking our meals, and Jenny fixing our hair. We'd told ourselves we loved Papa's servants as if they were family, and I might still argue that we did, but not with an eye to their humanity, with all the pain and possibility that entailed. Anger does not obliterate love, and love does not obliterate cruelty. Slavery was cruel, a sin against God and a betrayal of the principles of our revolution besides. And if we were ever to end it, the effort would have to begin with families like ours. When I said as much, Angelica sat back in her gilded armchair and closed her eyes. "I suppose that if it were to be publicly known your husband purchased slaves, it would be another hypocrisy for the newspapers to complain about. More importantly, it would impede his efforts to abolish slavery in New York." Angelica finally lifted her long lashes to slant me a glance. "I don't know how you stand it." "How I stand what?"
"Hamilton," she replied. "His vanity, his outrageous zeal. He never stops." This from the same woman who complained her husband had nothing to do. Though she still treated Alexander with affection and remained politically loyal to him, She was much more apt now to take my side in any disagreement.
She plainly believed that I'd been sent on another mission to protect my husband's reputation, and resented him for it.
But Alexander hadn't sent me. My responsibility as the general's wife was not, I knew, just to the general. It was also to set a moral example for the country he meant to defend. And even if I had no standing to do that in the matter of adultery, slavery was a more guilty sin by far. I'm not asking you to emancipate Sarah for my husband, nor for me. I ask you to free her and all your slaves, because slavery violates the rights endowed to us by our Creator. I used Mr. Jefferson's words to make an impression. And at this little bit of manipulation, she apprehended me, almost as if for the first time, giving me the strangest feeling of a shift in our relationship, in which she'd always been hitherto of superior rank. I was sure that she would do as I asked, but she wasn't happy about it. "Why, Mrs. General Hamilton, they say two people married long enough to one another might slowly become more alike, but I never did predict it. You are becoming him." Chapter 31. Autumn, 1799. Harlem, New York. There was something mesmerizing about the dueling pistols, with their gleaming dark walnut stocks, and the glint of the brass barrels, and the hair trigger that an expert duelist could use to gain an advantage over his opponent. Perhaps the allure was in the fact that something so beautiful could be so deadly.
"See how the hair trigger is disguised?"
my brother-in-law asked, as he showed them to my admiring sons, who all strained to get a closer look.
"Try for yourself."
Grinning, 17-year-old Philip took the weapon into his hands, clearly fascinated despite having handled his father's own weapons many times before.
"Did you have the hair trigger set in your duel, Uncle Church?"
Church settled back onto a divan beside my sister in the cottage we'd all rented together in the wilds of Harlem so that Peggy, Angelica, and I could share the season. Now our children and husbands crowded the place, making the perfect audience for Church to brag about his exploits.
"I wanted Aaron Burr to know that I could kill him without any advantage if I so chose," he said, coolly straightening his white lace cravat. "And perhaps I should have."
Alexander cut in with a reproachful glance at his brother-in-law. My husband was, after all, no longer the same man who became embroiled in two affairs of honor in a single day. As a general, he'd been working to eradicate the antiquated practice from the ranks of the army.
"I've been persuaded that dueling is a horrid custom, one the legislature must see fit to curb."
I wish now he'd said so much more. For the memory of our son Philip holding that pistol, even all these decades later, retains the power to make me want to retch. Alexander held out his hand for the pistol and returned the pair to their portmanteau, though that didn't effect a change of subject, because the men in my family were in a belligerent humor about Burr. When it looked certain that we'd go to war with France, Burr had volunteered to help defend the harbor, despite his earlier support of the French Revolution. Burr had also abandoned his fellow Republicans to support the anti-slavery measure in New York's legislature. He'd even proposed a new project to bring clean water to the city so as to prevent yellow fever. Alexander had been thrilled to see Burr's political changes, and he'd championed them. But it had been a scheme. My harried husband, busy arranging for military supplies and organizing the army, had missed a few legal clauses belatedly added to the paperwork for the water utility. Clauses that enabled Burr to transform the supposedly charitable corporation he started with my husband's help into a bank. A Republican bank. Burr had used him. It had been a masterful and malevolent joke, sly and well executed at the very time my husband was occupied in everything from designing military uniforms from sash to buttonhole
to recommending a military academy at West Point. Otherwise, Hamilton would never have been distracted enough to let Burr slip something past him. Seldom did anyone outsmart Alexander Hamilton. But Burr had done just that, in a most public and humiliating way. Alexander had privately fumed, but Church accused Burr of corruption, which brought about a duel between the men, where my brother-in-law proved himself such an expert marksman that he shot a button off Burr's coat, a feat that much impressed my sons, but not my sister. Hearing Church boast now about how he could have killed a man, Angelica set her cup down so hard that I feared it would crack, and strong black tea sloshed over both sides. For she, like the rest of us, had learned of her husband's duel only after the fact, and the fright of having so nearly been made a widow in complete ignorance still set her nerves on edge. "What if you had killed him, Jack?" Angelica asked. No one in our family seemed poised to answer that question, least of all my unrepentant brother-in-law. And over our teacups, Peggy and I exchanged a look, both of us knowing from childhood experience not to tangle with Angelica when she was in this mood. But as my newborn daughter mewled like a kitten in her cradle, I was emboldened to remind everyone of our blessings. "Let's just give thanks to God that no one was hurt, not to mention that we're all together to enjoy a respite in this beautiful countryside. A respite that would have been even more enjoyable if you'd named your new daughter Margaret," Peggy piped up, both changing the subject and professing jealousy that we'd named our first daughter after Angelica, but none after her. "I'm afraid I favor the name Elizabeth," Alexander replied with a wink. "But perhaps the next one."
"The next one? And to think I once feared Betsy would be a spinster. You're like rabbits, you two," Peggy accused, quite heedless of the agonized cringes this elicited from my sons and the chorus of snickers from their cousins, especially Angelica's 21-year-old Flip and Peggy's 11-year-old Stephen, where they stood still admiring Church's pistols in the open portmanteau. Reaching to pat my husband's knee, I said, "Since the gentlemen of the family have been so fixated on guns, perhaps you might take the boys into the woods and bring us some ducks for supper." Alexander looked as if he wished to protest, but called for his new hunting dog, an over-eager spaniel that answered to the name of Old Peggy. That's when my Philip joked to his aunt, "You have a Hamiltonian namesake after all." Peggy gave an indignant sputter that sounded quite like the curly-haired mongrel, eliciting howls of laughter from all of us. "My nephew is a rogue," Peggy said, affectionately ruffling Philip's dark hair. "Be gone with you to fetch our supper." Then Alexander marched off into the forests of Harlem with a fowling piece in hand, my brothers-in-law and our boys all trooping behind.
"Do you see how Church swaggers about like a daring boy of 18? Angelica hissed when they'd gone.
To soothe her, I said, "You were once charmed by Church's daring."
"That was before I loved him,"
Angelica replied, taking me quite by surprise. "When we eloped, that was just the seedling of love. It's taken years of careful tending, pruning, and cultivation to come to full flower. Though, if Church had gotten himself killed in a childish duel, I should doubt the whole enterprise of love altogether."
Peggy dramatically rolled her eyes. "Oh, how would it have looked if he'd refused Burr's challenge? It's the way men defend their personal honor."
Angelica seethed.
"It's never personal with Burr. Tell her, Eliza."
"It's true," I said, in the familiar role of mediator between them. As improbable as it sounded, Burr was, and had always been, wryly amused with life, taking it all for a game. "Burr only cares about his political reputation," Angelica said. "Now, thanks to my husband, that sly self-seeker can boast that he didn't flinch when a bullet came close enough to wing a button off his coat. He'll tell that story every chance he gets while campaigning for Jefferson in the upcoming presidential election. And mark me a fool if Burr doesn't win the vice presidency for himself.
Heaven forfend, I said, glad Alexander wasn't present to hear this prediction, for it would have sent him spiraling into a rage.
What I wanted was to celebrate with my sisters that we were all together, the three of us, our children playing together outside, our husbands good friends, just as I'd once dreamed we'd be. So I did my best to soften Angelica's temper until the three of us were laughing together, as we did when we were girls. I'll call her Lisbeth for short, I said to Peggy of the new daughter in my arms. And I am sorry, Peggy. I wanted to call her Margaret, but my husband is still persuasive when he desires something. She snorted. Oh, and I'll bet he knows just how to persuade you, too. No doubt it involves his... Say no more, I said, laughing despite myself. There's an innocent babe here. Chuckling, Peggy smoothed her hand over Lisbeth's downy hair. Call her what you like. It's just good to see you happy again. I was happy, I realized. The advantage of the Reynolds scandal was that I no longer had anything to hide. I found satisfaction in my work and in Alexander's. For on the 4th of July, we'd toasted the state legislature's passage of a law establishing the gradual abolition of slavery. And shortly thereafter, Alexander had taken me to scout a property he meant to buy for our home, a high wooded place not far from the river. The country still feared an American war with France, with that tyrant, Napoleon Bonaparte. But with Washington and Hamilton at the head of our armies, we could be in no safer hands. Doctor, I die hard, but I am not afraid to go. George Washington. December, 1799, New York City. George Washington's passing shook the very foundations of the country. Few men on earth had done more to earn eternal rest than the former president, but we were left like children frightened to face a world without him. Even Alexander, though he was loath to admit it. Nevertheless, like a grieving son, my husband went to Philadelphia to march in a somber funereal procession in honor of his fallen chief, wearing a black sash of mourning, leading a white riderless horse from Congress Hall, accompanied by a solitary drumbeat. But where were the rest of the country's supposedly great men? One would have searched the assembled crowd in vain for Jefferson, Madison, or Monroe. Though I could well imagine the three Republicans clustered around a dinner table, wickedly toasting Washington's demise and the opportunity it now gave their party to rise to power. For my part, I was forced to steal away to the privacy of my room so that the children would not see my tears fall as I remembered the first time that godlike man spoke my name in welcoming me to his military encampment. My heart bled for Martha. She must feel so alone now, I thought. Inconsolable. She'd had children from her first marriage, but none with Washington. And she'd had only 2 years with her husband after a lifetime of public service. Only 2 years to sit together upon their piazza overlooking the Potomac and dine together in the privacy of their rooms. And yet, even then, I knew Mount Vernon resembled a well-resorted tavern, with people stopping by for a glimpse of the former president and an expectation of southern hospitality. A meal, a room for the night, a stable with feed for their horses, all at Washington's expense, of course. We consumed him, I thought, clutching the pendant I wore containing his hair. We might not have chopped off Washington's head and lapped up his blood from the paving stones, as the French mobs did with their king, but we'd taken the best years of his life, his sweat, his toil, his wisdom, his vigor and energies. And what did we give him in return? For 8 years we called him president.
Now we called him the father of the country. Who then was the heir? All eyes, it seemed, turned to an increasingly erratic President John Adams. But finding him wanting, some looked to Alexander Hamilton. And for the first time, I found myself almost grateful for the exposure of my husband's infidelity, because it meant that he hadn't the stature to run for the presidency. Not now, at least.
We were stuck with President Adams.
The alternative was unthinkable. The alternative was Jefferson. "Did you remember to deliver the parcel to Widow Rhinelander?" I asked Philip, when he absconded with a piece of bread, trying to slip out the back door.
"I could scarcely forget, with all your reminders."
My tall son leaned against the butcher block table in the basement kitchen of our rented townhouse, affecting a manly devil-may-care pose. He was still dutiful about helping to deliver baskets to the needy, but having graduated from Columbia College, he would not be at my beck and call for long. He was grown now, and keen to prove it.
"Fortunately, Mrs. Rhinelander has a very pretty girl living next door to her."
"Naughty young man," I scolded. For he was entirely too much like his father had once been, irresistibly brilliant, shamelessly flirtatious, and outrageously handsome. I'd already had to warn him against making eyes at our pot-scrubbing girl. Now I snatched the butter before he absconded with it, too.
"Don't make me fear to send you on errands for the charity, lest you flirt with the ladies."
"I wouldn't flirt with Widow Rhinelander."
Philip's mouth twisted into a feigned expression of horror, and he shuddered.
"She reminds me of the Baron von Steuben, may he rest in peace. Besides, she says all her German gentlemen friends are voting Republican."
Of course they were. Which was why, for the coming elections, I found myself undertaking the most energetic role in the political wrangling that I could without forfeiting my dignity as a lady. While going door to door and church to church raising charitable donations, I'd made careful note of those with Federalist sympathies who might be approached for support. Every day that my husband, who should have been about the business of the military, rode hither and yon, haranguing passing crowds on street corners, attending committee meetings in various wards, and even enlisting our sons to stand watch at polling stations where we suspected election trickery, I pinned my black Federalist cockade to my hat and went out to praise the virtues of courage and perseverance in the Federalist cause. It was an unseemly business to electioneer in support of President Adams, but we'd been forced to it by Aaron Burr, who opened his house to offer refreshments and a mattress upon the floor to any grubby miscreant willing to campaign for a populist sweep of Jeffersonians into the government. And now Philip complained,
"It seems Colonel Burr sent someone to the neighborhood who spoke German, and he's drawing up lists of voters in all the immigrant precincts."
"For all the good it will do him," I said smugly. "To vote, immigrants must have resided here 14 years and own substantial property." But having embarked upon the study of the law in his father's footsteps, Philip explained,
"Burr's found a legal loophole. He's going to have them pool the value of their property so they can qualify to vote."
Damn, Aaron Burr. Was there no end to his schemes? Of course, it was just what Alexander would have done if he'd thought of it. My husband had, after all, filled the Federalist slate with booksellers, a grocer, a mason. Precisely the sort of working people who ought to appeal to populists. And, as if in diabolical mockery, Burr filled the Republican slate with rich and venerable old Clintonites and Livingstons for the cachet of their family names. Despite what he'd said to me on the street that day, however, I didn't think Burr's tireless campaigning came from any principled stance. He simply wanted to be vice president. And perhaps that wouldn't be so terrible an ambition if he didn't want to serve under Jefferson, who would assuredly plunge us back into a world of chaos, starvation, and riots. "We'd better warn your father," I said,
grabbing up the lunch basket I'd filled with fruit and pastries.
I wouldn't open my home with mattresses on the floor for every mercenary willing to campaign under my husband's generalship, but I was determined to feed and encourage the troops.
As I searched for Alexander and passed out my baked goods to my husband's loyalists on the streets, I heard the most outrageous talk amongst the milling crowds. Hollow, ignorant Republican slogans, curses and taunts at our party's volunteers, libelous rumors about President Adams. I felt a growing dread that if we lost this election, my future and that of my children would be thrown into a world characterized by such vitriol, all at the hands of Jefferson, an atheist in religion and a fanatic in politics.
"I would see half the earth desolated," Jefferson once said to me.
That must not be allowed to happen. I finally found my husband outside a notorious boarding house on Greenwich Street, warning a discontented crowd of ruffians against a Jefferson presidency.
"Alexander,"
I called, attempting to push through them with my basket. But he didn't hear me, and they refused to hear him. Instead, the man shouted him down.
"Thief! Rascal! Villain!"
They cursed my husband, their general, a man still in uniform with a sword on his hip. Stunned, I took a step back and quite nearly bumped into the Quaker proprietress of the boarding house, waving her arms at my husband and shrieking,
"If thee dies a natural death, Hamilton, I shall think there is no justice in heaven. I'll never support anything you're about. I tell all my boarders to vote with Burr."
It wasn't the first time that proprietress had accosted him. She'd done it months before in a courtroom where Alexander had defended the man accused of murdering her cousin. The trial had created a sensation, especially when Alexander exposed the proprietress as running a bit of a bawdy house, so it didn't surprise me to hear the woman shriek and rave. Outraged, my husband tugged his military coat straight.
"Here now!"
The growing crowd drowned him out with a raucous cheer of support for the proprietress, one that made me anxious.
"Alexander," I said, finally forcing my way through to him.
"Oh, dear Eliza, it's too rowdy out here today for you."
He took my basket and sheltered me away from the unruly mob with an arm around my shoulders. But frustration rolled off him.
"Why does that lady not recall that Aaron Burr was the other defense attorney in that case? Why doesn't she blame him, too?"
"Because Burr is slippery,"
I replied when we finally found a bit of privacy in the doorway to a millinery shop. The sort of fellow off the surface of whom can slide almost any resentment. Whereas, when it came to Alexander, everything stuck. Perhaps that was because Burr's ancestry stretched back to Jonathan Edwards, one of the great New England theologians, whereas Hamilton was said to be a Creole bastard. Or perhaps it was because Burr never proclaimed any position on anything until he knew which way the wind was blowing, whereas Hamilton could never keep an opinion to himself. Late that night, sinking in exhausted despondency beside his father in the parlor, Philip groaned,
"Our state election is over. They've swept the slate. It's all Republicans."
New York would give 12 electoral college votes to Jefferson, enough, quite possibly, to tip the balance of the presidency. And it was all accomplished by the wily Aaron Burr, who had, in the late hours of the election, gotten every man who couldn't vote to bring out wagon loads of those who could, even carrying the infirm and sitting them down on chairs in the middle of the cobblestone street to wait their turn. We'd lost New York. My general had been out-generaled. I suppose it had always seemed impossible to me that Alexander could fail at anything he set his mind to. And so I sank down, too, numbly. But at the stroke of midnight, Alexander was already at his desk, drawing up new battle plans. Feverishly, he scratched out a letter to the governor, audaciously suggesting that presidential electors should be chosen by popular vote, rather than by the incoming legislature. Such a measure would be seen as overturning the election, I warned, hoping to dissuade him from sending it, and would surely cause a civil war.
A civil war would be preferable to Jefferson, Philip said,
perhaps remembering the sermon we'd heard at church, telling us that if Jefferson became president, we'd have to hide our Bibles.
In times like these, it will not do to be over-scrupulous, Alexander said, still writing. It's easy to sacrifice the substantial interests of society by a strict adherence to ordinary rules. This is a matter of public safety.
Remembering Jefferson's admiration for and encouragement of the Francophile mobs in Philadelphia, I agreed with him. That our fright drove us to consider radical and unsavory ideas in the few terrifying days after the election, what some were already calling the Revolution of 1800, I don't deny. But our fever-induced proposals were never adopted, whereas the worst panic-struck ideas of President Adams were immediately put into action. Realizing he was likely to lose the election, the first thing Adams did was fire his entire cabinet, including the Secretary of War.
But the president blames you more than anyone for his probable defeat, Ham,
McHenry said, having come straight from Philadelphia to report the news. He glanced at me apologetically as he pushed away his dinner plate, having apparently lost his appetite.
Adams thinks you brought about the loss of the election in New York intentionally.
The indignity of it, after all we'd done. My own appetite wavered. Mac added,
Adams shouted that you've been trying to control the government while posing as a private man, that you're a man devoid of every moral principle, a bastard and a foreigner besides.
I flinched, because it was an insult designed to strike at my husband's weakest points, and an unworthy and unbecoming thing for the President of the United States to stoop to say besides. But worse, few men were more American than Alexander Hamilton, and yet the President proclaimed him a foreigner. The same President who had the power to deport foreigners he deemed dangerous to the peace. Alexander flung his napkin onto the table in disgust.
Not only the worst constructions are put upon my conduct as a public man, but it seems my birth must still be the subject of the most humiliating criticism.
I put a hand on my husband's knee in comfort. His birth wasn't his fault, and yet, no conduct of his could ever seem to change it. And even McHenry seemed sensible of the wound he'd opened.
My dear Hamilton, with respect to the legitimacy of your birth, none of your friends would respect you less, even if everything your enemies say on this head were true. Well, that is kind, Mac,
Hamilton allowed.
But my friends are precious few.
That was only partially true, I thought. Because even then, my husband still wore the aura of a victor. His star had dimmed, but still blazed. And I confused followers for friends. I know better now. But at the time, I merely smiled at McHenry in gratitude.
Mac gave a long sigh. While I'm at it, you might as well know this, too. During his tirade against me, the president declared Mr. Jefferson an infinitely better man than you, one who, if president, would act wisely. He said he'd rather be vice president under Jefferson than indebted to you, a man who ruled George Washington and would rule still if he could.
I understood what this meant, and chills raised goose flesh on my arms. John Adams is changing sides. He's going to abandon the Federalists.
McHenry nodded. You're not the only one to think the president has cut a deal with Jefferson to save his own neck.
At that, Alexander abruptly rose from the table to pace behind the chairs, and looked as if he wished to throw one of them out our bow window into the street below.
The man is more mad than I ever thought him, which he just might force me to say.
I was inclined to agree. Adams was going to abandon us to the bloodthirsty clutches of the Republican mob, who blamed my husband for every unpopular act of his own administration. And for the first time since the days of the Revolution of 76, I began to consider that we might need to flee. McHenry did nothing to change my mind. Certainly, the president spoke in ways to persuade me he's